You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Guidepost. We have a super special treat today. And not only is it going to be today, but this is going to be a series. And, you know, I don't know if y'all like it. This is going to go on for a long time. So we kind of got stuck in a rut. And it was always like fish policy, fish science, doom and gloom. The end is near. Oh, man, you know, send a letter, sign our letter. And, you know, fishing's so much more than that. So believe me, we got a lot of doom and gloom to talk about. But, you know, we also want to have a little bit of fun and we want to teach y'all some things. You know, we did the shop talk deal with me and Kyle and Blaine and Cody, and we got a lot of positive response on that. So we're going to definitely do more of those. And we actually have a really funny one planned for the next one that I know everyone will enjoy. But this one, we're going to start a little bit of an educational series. Now, I have a special guest today. His name is Ben Meadows, and we're really fortunate that, you know, the universe connected us. But Ben is a PhD in natural resources economics, and I'm going to stop right there, and I'm going to let Ben introduce himself and kind of, you know, give a little bit of his background and education, and we're going to get right into it. Ben, thank you for joining us today, buddy.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tony. Yeah, so my name is Ben Meadows. I am an environmental and natural resource economist. I kind of wear many different hats, from teaching economics to large section classes to doing research within environmental and energy economics. And then as well, and this is kind of how we all got connected, was also an outdoor filmmaker. So wear a lot of hats, do a lot of different things. But yeah, it's been great kind of getting to know y'all and getting to work with y'all. Was really inspired by the work y'all were doing for Louisiana Redfish. I'm from Alabama, if you can't tell from my nasty accent. And I grew up loving redfish, even when they didn't love me back. There was plenty of times when I would go a long time without getting a redfish. But that species has always been near and dear to my heart. So yeah, it's great to link up with y'all, and great to jump on the podcast. I hope, yeah, that we can kind of uncover some economics that we all are going to understand and love as outdoors folks, and hopefully learn a little more.
Well, I'll tell you, Ben, it's really interesting. You know, you mentioned that we had connected through redfish, and I'll tell you, this is a true story. You know, we kind of wear our hearts on our sleeve, and we really personally care about the people that we represent. And at the time that you called, we had won, you know, two in a row, big decisions on redfish. And then we went to the state legislature and got our asses handed to us. Man, it was tough, not because we lost, but to see, you know, all the good people, our members in Louisiana, you know, basically get their first defeat in advocacy, you know, right there at the state capitol. It's hard to see that when people really care. So we all flew home, and there's all this stuff going on, and, you know, we petitioned the governor to veto the decision by the oversight committee, and we're throwing everything. And Cody, everybody knows Cody. Cody said, "Hey, boss, what's our Hail Mary? What's the last thing we can do?" And you can ask Cody, Ben. I swear to you, I said to him, "I don't know, but it's going to come." And when it comes, we got to be ready. Because at that point, I had exhausted everything that I knew. And then about 24 hours later, you got in touch with us and basically said, I love redfish and I can help. I have a PhD in economics, natural resources economics, and I think I can help y'all. And that's a God's honest truth. And Ben, that's how it happened, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because I think I was inspired by it. We were, my business partner at Dorsal Outdoor, George Constantine, we had had this trip booked to film some Louisiana redfish that weekend. And so, when that decision was handed down, I remember, sending y'all a message and saying, hey, there seems to be some disconnect at the State Department or however you want to refer to the kind of folks in power about the economic valuation of redfish. And so I was like, look, this is what I do. Would do y'all need help in that regard? And then we were off to the races and I'm writing an economic report.
Oh, we were all up. I mean, Ben, we were all up. You were driving to Louisiana to go fishing. Me and Cody were reaching out to everyone in Louisiana that's our members. We were like, hold your hats inbound, you know. We did a video. I mean, it was it's why we do this work. Now, for what it's worth, you know, the governor didn't veto it, but we're back in the trenches and we're still fighting for redfish in Louisiana. It's coming up again, but now we have all this crazy information to kind of substantiate what we're saying. So, you know, data is really hard for people to understand. And when I mean data, I mean like counting fish. You know, like it's because it's a statistical program. It doesn't make a lot of sense to people. But I think what makes a lot of sense to people is the economics of fishing. And that's what you do. So if we were all going to go back to school, we'll call this episode Back to School. Now, for y'all who don't know, I think I've mentioned this a couple of times. I have an undergrad in economics. I still don't feel comfortable speaking about economics to Ben. So that's a good thing. Ben has a PhD. I have an undergrad, and I don't even want to get into my GPA. But we're all going to go back to school, including me. I guarantee you, Ben teaches college classes. I was the student that would have made Ben roll his eyes the most. I was kind of my own version of Tommy Boy in school, but I made it and I got the degree. But let's all go back to school. And what we want to do for this episode is focus on some real simple stuff that tells us a lot about the stuff that we care about, which is the natural world, conservation, and of course, fishing. So, Ben, I think I set you up pretty good. Take us back to school, buddy.
All right. I hope everybody's got their paper and pencil ready to go. Or now, kids these days, it's iPads and styluses. So, you know, I ban laptops in the classroom because I'm like, if I can't pay attention, there's no way a 19-year-old can pay attention on a laptop. So, I'm excited to do this. So, let's start off with a very like basics, like what in the world is economics? If you're listening to us right now, a couple things just popped in your head. The study of the stock market, the study of money, the study of banking. And I'll tell you, none of those interest me. If that was what economics was about, I would not be an economist. I have no interest in that. What economics actually is, and you could, Tony, if you went back to your old textbooks, you'd actually see this. Economics is how individuals and societies deal with scarcity. Now, again, only an economist would be like, well, let's unpack that definition. But we have to, okay? We have to unpack that definition. And scarcity, right, is the fact that we don't have enough of all the things in the world to satisfy our wants and needs. There's just not enough to go around in every context. I was actually talking to my students about this today. In college, it feels like the two things you never have enough of is money and time. And of course, then as an older dude, I told him, I'm like, congrats, that's not going to change as soon as you leave college. You're never going to have enough money. You're never going to have enough time. And so you have to figure out how to manage those resources to their highest value. And if you're kind of a resource person or, you know, an angler, this should all be ringing bells right now of like, oh my gosh, yeah, that's what we try to do with natural resources, right? We don't have unlimited redfish stocks. We don't have unlimited albie stocks. We don't have unlimited, like, you know, put and take fisheries. So we have to manage these to their highest value. And that's what economics is. And so typically in economics, we talk about a grand trade-off, meaning that because we can't have everything we want and need, we have to make trade-offs between the little we have and what we don't have. And typically what we're talking about there is what we would call efficiency and equity. So efficiency is using your resources to the highest, best, punchiest value, and equity is distributing it fairly. And any dad, mom, uncle, aunt knows this very well, right? You can't have both. You can't have maximum potential or fairness at once. You kind of have to decide somewhere on that sliding scale where to go. There's probably not enough time to talk about this today, but I actually introduce it to my students when a couple buddies of mine and I got marooned on an island while fishing for bonefish. We were idiots. We were young, ran out of gas, got marooned on an uninhabited island. And we, because again, let me emphasize, we were idiots, only had a couple bottles of water and some snacks. We had to decide how you distribute those resources to try to get off the damn island. And what we realized is that everybody could have a small piece of the granola bar and some sips of the water bottle, or you could give it to one person who would be the runner to go get help. And that's kind of the tension we always see in economics, of that you can distribute some things fairly, or you can, you know, push things to their highest potential.
Yeah, Ben, remember I told you my GPA stunk? Like, I would have turned that into Lord of the Flies right away. And like, that's all I'll say, man. Like, I'd be in the corner like, yeah, y'all divvy up the water bottle and be lashing a rock to a palm frond and be like, yeah, y'all go on ahead and do that. It's fine. I'm just trying to make y'all laugh. Keep going, Ben. I don't want any of my dumbness to affect you through osmosis.
No, this is just how it works, man. That's trade-offs. And so, so yeah, I won't go into that story too much, but the idea typically when we are investigating trade-offs in economics is thinking about, you know, do we want efficiency or do we want equity? And as an economist, typically, since I'm not trained as an ethicist, I'm really focused on the efficiency point of view. How can we get the highest value out of the resources we have? Now, if you're a listener and you're like, wait, how do you get the highest value out of resources, especially when they are catch and release fisheries and we don't have a good number around those? Well, stay tuned. Tony and I have this teed up so that I will be walking y'all through some of the tools that economists use when there's not a market, when there's not a price tag, because we all know, like, the value of a redfish is not the price of a fillet, the pound per fillet, right? The value of a redfish, the value of a striped bass is so much more than that. And so we're gonna talk about some of those economic tools down the line. But today I just want to set that firm foundation that in econ, we're dealing with scarcity because we just don't have enough, so that we have to figure out the trade-offs we're facing between, again, like I said, the classic one is equity and efficiency. But I mean, let's keep it super modern. Let's talk about menhaden fisheries, right? There's a huge trade-off right now. The fact of, do these commercial fisheries continue to do what they're doing and earn an economic return, right? It's not that, you know, these pokey boats or menhaden boats, whatever you want to say, they're not doing it just for funsies. There's obviously some cash that's involved here. But the classic trade-off we're seeing for fisheries, right, is like, do we want the money that comes from menhaden oil and menhaden meal production, or do we want, you know, kind of a robust food chain that supports the fisheries that we all enjoy? And that's a trade-off, right? Let's be clear. You can't have both. You can have a little bit and a little bit, but you can't have both. Fully robust stocks and then up and running commercial fisheries for menhaden. And so that would be our first lesson of econ. If everything is scarcity, then everything we're going to be doing is talking about trade-offs, right? And this is where, you know, when we talk about slot limits, when we talk about, you know, creel reductions and things like that. That's a trade-off. These are all trade-offs, and you'll hear me over and over as we do this. I try not to make it a right or wrong thing. I'm not trying to make it a right or wrong answer. I'm trying to just, as an economist, say, hey, here are the trade-offs we're facing, and we need to embrace these with kind of some due diligence.
Wow. You know the cool thing? I'm not lost yet. So I'm actually rolling with this. So, you know, it is a trade-off. And the other thing that I would say is, you know, I think part of this big fisheries world is you try to find ways to live together with people who have different goals for the fishery. But sometimes you get to a point, whether the fishery is going downhill far enough or, you know, it's tough. But I would say the trade-off is always almost like a moving bar, right? Like it's dependent upon stock health and
right. And
a million other things. And those trade-offs can go up and down pretty fast, you know, and change an awful lot. So now we've learned about trade-off and opportunity costs. What's next, Dr. Meadows?
Oh, no, you've teed me up great. Well, let's talk about opportunity costs, because this is actually one of my favorite economic concepts. Super simple, but I think it's something that we often forget in the real world. So economists define opportunity costs as, you know, if you're going to get something, you have to give up something else to get it. And so
Can I do a fisherman's definition?
I'm ready, man.
An opportunity cost for going fishing on your mother-in-law's birthday. There are trade-offs, because you're gonna get some things and you're not gonna get others. So I like to put these terms and stuff that our whole audience can understand. So please continue, sir.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, hey, maybe that's the opportunity cost we all acknowledge. You get the right tide, the right wind, the right sun, the right push of everything you want to see, but you've got some big meetings scheduled that day. The opportunities cost, what do you got to give up to get to that fishery? Oh, the hell your boss is going to give you. And you just have to decide, is that worth it? I think everyone right now is nodding almost to the point of getting in a car wreck and saying, yeah, that's worth it. That's absolutely worth it. But for me, as an economist, I see people skipping over this all the time. They're like, what's the cost? What's the cost of this regulation? Well, it's X number of dollars. As an economist, I'm like, no, hold on. What are we going to give up by not enacting this regulation? What are we giving up by doing this? That's always the thing. And so we'll keep it super simple too, right? If you have to go fill up, say, 5 gallons of gas in your car, you know, and gas is $3 a gallon where you are, that's $15. So you're like, Ben, the opportunity cost of filling up my gas tank is $15. No, it's not. How else would you like to spend $15? Would you like to get a couple flies, some new fly tying materials? Would you like to, you know, I don't know, go to Chipotle and get a drink, right? The opportunity cost is whatever you're giving up to get that gas. And I think this really matters in natural resources, because we typically try to make things, we either try to make things that are already dollars and cents, just dollars and cents, or we try to make things that don't have dollar tags on them even more confusing. And I think if we try to really lean into the opportunity cost, and I think this is what y'all were kind of doing with the Louisiana redfish stocks, is like the opportunity cost of inaction is a crushed stock for years and years to come. It's a crushed stock for, you know, future generations to deal with. That's the opportunity cost of inaction. And I think that's what gets a lot of us going, is like, once we realize there is a cost to inaction, and it's a big one, that's when opportunity costs can really kind of sink its teeth in. And I tell my students all the time, I can ruin you, because all you're going to do when you look out in the world is see opportunity costs. When you stop looking at dollar figures and you start thinking about opportunity costs, it kind of peels back the veil a little bit. And so that would be your second lesson of going back to school in economics, is, you know, opportunity costs.
Husbands, fathers, you know, well, of course, We got a lot of ladies listening to this too, but husbands, fathers, wives, parents, you know, we're we were someone's kids at some point. For me, that was a real long time ago. But there's opportunity costs, right? There's opportunity costs for going fishing and not doing your homework. There's opportunity costs, I don't know, for telling your mom you're going to school and you go fishing. And then a teacher drives by the lake. You know, there's all sorts of opportunity costs. And that's something I think that's super relatable. Basically, I look at it as you make a decision, you got to live with it, and something's going to happen, right? And it and it might not be that great. And boy, do we have some opportunity costs, you know, particularly with striped bass right now. So next thing, marginal analysis. This is where I start to
Don't click off, folks. Don't click off, folks. Y'all think it's nerdy and you're going to quit.
No. Listen. Don't keep it going in your car. This is actually going to be a fun part.
All right. So marginal analysis, we're going to build on what we learned on with scarcity and with opportunity costs to really reflect how we make good economic decisions. So the idea here is that for every action you're going to take, there are benefits and there's costs. Now, that's pretty clear up and down. The EPA actually is they are required to do cost-benefit analysis, so we're not going to get into that. What I'm talking about here when we say marginal analysis is that think about you're on a flat or you're in the river or you're on the beach and you're fishing, and you're like, I really want to fish for one more hour. Should I fish for one more hour? And so in your head, if you're a fishing econ nerd, all three of us in the world, what you would think about is, okay, there's marginal benefits for me staying out here, okay? For that 1 hour, you can't be like, oh, yeah, I'm going to continue having a great day. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about being out there for one more hour. So in that 1 hour, I could enjoy the rest of the tide push. I could catch a couple more fish. I could, you know, finally do what we all say we're going to and take a deep breath and actually just enjoy being out there and not focusing on catching a fish. But in that next hour, those are some of the benefits. Now, there's obviously costs to me staying out there. It could be, you know, little things like boat gas and if you're as pale as I am, a sunburn that you're going to get for staying out in the sun too long. But for most of us, we're actually talking about opportunity costs here. We're talking about the fact that for that next hour you're on the water, you are giving up time with friends, you are giving up time with family, you're giving up time that you could be working. And so you in yourself have to decide for that next hour, do the benefits outweigh the cost? Is it good for me to stay out and fish for one more hour? Because if it's not, if you're like, well, the tide sucks, I'm not going to catch any fish, I'm in a rotten mood, I'm not going to really enjoy this, then go home. Put the motor down or get your feet to walk in and go home, because the marginal costs are greater than the marginal benefit. So I think that's like a simple analogy that we can kind of hook our minds around. But I think this really comes home to roost when we think about policy and big actions we see kind of on a larger stage of, okay, marginal analysis of closing a fishery for 10 more days if we're trying to do a spawning season that we're protecting. Okay. What are the benefits of closing off a fishery for 10 more days? Well, we would hope that we would see better recruitment. We'd see better, hopefully, spawning numbers for doing that, although there's going to be some randomness associated with it. So it's hard to measure those benefits. But then people are going to hammer us, right? Because we know the costs are a lot of people not being able to fish, a lot of guys not being able to put their boats in the water, a lot of folks not being able to travel. And how do we know we're making the right decision?
And you're shifting that effort to when you can fish.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a
more people. If you say you can't fish for these 2 weeks, you're probably going to double the effort for the next 2 weeks. It's tough.
Right. And this is what I love about economics is that where other things might pretend to have a cut and dry answer, economics will typically hit you with the spectrum and be like, look, based on a couple of, you know, estimates here, it looks like the marginal benefits do outweigh the marginal costs. Let's keep this thing closed for a little bit. But then other times it'll flip around and it's like, no, no, you're going to lose out on so much tourism, the overcapacity that you talked about, Tony. And it flips the other direction. And it's like, no, 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 this doesn't make sense. But it gives you a clear lens of how to think about this. And that's what I really enjoy about economics, is that here we are, a few minutes in. I could go all day. I know that's not what your listeners want. I could go all day on this, but we're already, using some very simple tools that help us clarify our position. And that's where I think economics is actually a pretty winsome, we're called the dismal science, but I think we're a pretty winsome science, because we can kind of cut through opinion and say, look, here are the marginal benefits, here are the marginal costs. How do we feel about these? Does this line up with the objectives, the policy goals that we have, so that we can move forward with kind of, clear eyes? And again, this is just, marginal analysis is something that the more you do it, the more you will see it everywhere. And for an economist, what we typically think of is that if you're investing in something, you want to keep investing or keep doing something until the marginal benefit goes all the way to equaling the marginal cost. And maybe this is a quibbling point we don't want to get on too much, but it's the idea of, like, there's marginal benefits to rebuilding a stock, and probably at first those benefits well exceed the marginal cost. So let's keep doing it. And so then remeasure marginal benefits, marginal costs. Oh yeah, still the marginal benefits of rebuilding the stock way bigger than the marginal costs. But at some point that stops. Some of you are like pounding your steering wheel and you're like, oh, are we talking about equilibrium? Maybe, kind of. We're getting close, right, to a point where the marginal benefits of rebuilding.
I'll admit it. I was going to say that to sound smart. I'm glad I didn't. I was like, I think he's talking about equilibrium. What's the delta? And I'm like, I'll just shut up now.
But there is, and again, this would be more fun, like with a whiteboard. You can tell I'm a nerd when I do that. But there's an idea here that at some point you will get less of return, the marginal benefits of rebuilding the stock towards the end of it, towards you hitting that goal, which is a good thing. The marginal costs of rebuilding that stock further are going to be more costly than the benefits received. And you'll be like, okay, now we know we're at the economic position we want to be at. I don't think there's a lot of fisheries where that's true, but it's still a really helpful framework from the economics to help us kind of understand when a win is, wow, that's too many wins in one sentence. When a policy win has happened is when those marginal benefits and marginal costs equal one another.
Well, Ben, I think a lot of it's, so what you just said, like, the connection that I see with fishermen is, there's a lot of fishermen that are business people, and, this resonates with anyone who kind of operates in their daily life, whether it's one of our guides or whose life, life and livelihood depend upon this, or it's a private rec angler. But, when you start weighing this out, let's say we're at 95% of the target spawning stock biomass for stripers, getting to that 100 might be painful, and it's not going to have the impact that you get from, like, let's say 50% of the SSB to 70%. But, your goal is the target, but your gains start to wane as you get closer and closer to that target.
Right. I wish the listeners could see my head nodding, because I probably nearly snapped my neck nodding along, because that's it. You've nailed it, is that as we get closer and closer to our policy goals, the marginal benefits are getting smaller. They're getting smaller. That doesn't mean that's bad. It's just saying, like, look, when you move from 25 to 35, that's a big jump, because the species is so depressed at that point. But when we move from 95 to 97, that's a small jump and you've already recovered the stock and it's likely going to be really costly, right? Because you've now got to kind of up the ante on whatever policy you're going. I mean, I think I know there's some general disagreement on freshwater on stocking plans and things like that, but let's just kind of keep it anonymous here. But imagine a redfish stocking plan was something that someone wanted to do. That to kind of leverage what you're talking about on investment and people who work in business, right? If I'm going to invest $100 in a company, I better see, right, $101 come back to me or more, otherwise it's a lousy investment. The same thing can be said about natural resources, right? If I invest in a stocking program and it's not giving me back that investment, then it's not the right play. But like we were saying, when you're early on, like if you're resorting to a stocking routine, that means it's really, really bad. And you're going to see for $100 in, you're going to see $200 come out. And that's what all we're trying to do in natural resource economics is apply these very normal business tools to the natural world, because, and we'll get into this in later episodes, the opportunity cost of ignoring the economics of these things is people start to perceive the value as $0 because we don't actually do the good economic analysis. People start to perceive the dollar value for these resources is zero. And that's when they get taken advantage of. That's when they get preyed upon. And that's when you guys have to saddle up and start to make things happen because people are saying, well, the perceived value is zero. And it's like, no, we know that's incorrect. So that's why I feel really passionate, right, about making sure we nail these economic foundations because it's important. It just is really, really important moving into the future. Well,
you know, if we have another topic to cover here on back to school night. But before we do that, you know, I think my reactions are pretty much, I would say, the common man reaction, right? When I hear you talking, I'm thinking about different fisheries we work on. And like, you know, so many times the value of the fish is dead on the dock. And there's certainly a value in that. You know, there's a prop there. If it's a commercially harvested fish, there's a pound there, there's a price per pound. And as it matriculates through the system and ends up at a restaurant and everything, there's economic impact all along the way. But one of the things in my time working in fisheries policy and science is the lack of information out there that says this is how much the fish is worth if it's caught and released and essentially recycled. And it, let's make the assumption that it survives release. A disproportionate number of them do, especially if they're handled correctly. And we got to, as a group, we got to get better at that. And that's my job to kind of educate people. But there's just no information out there. There's a little bit, there's a couple of things out there, but I mean, it's really lacking to be able to connect those dots and say, well, this guy bought a boat. This guy filled it with gas X amount of times. He went on X amount of trips. He spent X amount on tackle. And he didn't want to kill anything. He just went out there for the experience and he caught and released fish. It still had an economic impact. And if the fish survived release and was caught by another person who released it or a commercial fisherman who harvested it and sold it, that's like a double whammy impact, you know, because the fish was used more than once in the economic chain. And it's just the catch and look, we kill fish, man. And you and I, before we started the podcast, we were talking a little bit about duck hunting. And you know, the difference between hunting and fishing is when you pull the trigger, you make the decision. And when you're fishing, you make the decision when you're holding that fish in the boat. And if it's, you know, legal size, you're under your creel limit. That's your decision as a fisherman. And only you're going to make that. Do you put it in the box or do you let it go? And a lot of people make those that A or B decision for different reasons. And that is fine. As long as you're within the law, it's perfectly fine. But we need to quantify the people that make that decision, say, you know what, I'm going to let this one go. And I think that's really the important part of this relationship. And the last thing I'll tell the listeners before we go on to the next topic, I'm so excited for it. It's going to be one of the few things I remember, spoiler alert. The one thing just to get people excited about is right now, Ben and the ASGA team and a whole slew of scientists and supporters are working on doing an incredibly robust economic analysis of the catch and release fishery on the East Coast of the United States. It's going to take a little bit of time, but if we come on this podcast 2 months from now or a month from now and say, y'all need to take this survey, it's going to be super important for management moving forward. And you're listening to the individual that's going to be quantifying those numbers for us and coming up with a product that hopefully, you know, we can make sure that Albies are around for everyone for generations to come. So just to get everyone kind of excited, this is much more than just your back to school night. You're actually listening to the guy that's going to put a huge missing piece of the puzzle, you know, snap that little jigsaw piece into place for us. So, okay, we've talked about trade-offs. We've talked about opportunity costs. We've talked about marginal costs in that analysis. The next thing, just common sense-wise, folks, is supply and demand. Take it away, Dr. Meadows.
So, yeah, I hope that some of y'all, when we said what is economics, you're like supply and demand, because at least you're in the right ballpark of what we try to do day in and day out in economics. And I'll be honest, Tony, I'm going to kind of punt on a little bit of the really good application of supply and demand, because we're going to need this tool when we talk about it later on how we value the non-monetary benefits of catch and release fishing. You teed it up perfectly, Tony, but I don't think we'll have enough time tonight to go all the way there. But I think we've got to nail supply and demand so folks understand where these economic tools are coming from, because I think it's important. I think it's important. There is a branch of economic analysis that it's done by non-PhD economists that just throws these insane astronomical numbers around for funsies, and that's not what we're doing. We're doing science. We are trying to nail down the non-market. When I say non-market, that means there is not a dollar amount. When you catch a redfish and you release it, it does not charge your bank account $17 for that redfish. Like there's no way for you to, in a market way, to know how much a redfish costs or is how much it's valued. So we have to have economic tools to do that. And to figure that out and to explain that, we got to go back to our roots, which is supply and demand. So if you're driving, please keep both hands on the wheel. If you're not driving, let's do a little kind of Mickey Mouse training exercise here. So imagine you've got a graph and it's right in front of your eyeballs. Draw a line with your right finger. Start in the top left-hand corner and go to the right-hand corner below it. It's a nice little down-sloping line. Do it a couple times. It soothes my economic soul doing that. A couple of you are like, what a nerd, and that's couldn't be more right. Right? What you're tracing out is what we would econ would call a demand curve. It follows the law of demand, you know, like kind of like the law of gravity, right? Well, what goes up must come down. Well, in economics, the law of demand says as price goes up, quantity demanded goes down. Or if you're like, wait, Ben, my finger wasn't going that way. I got you. Okay. As price goes down, quantity demanded goes up. The lower the price, the more you want of it. Okay, this is just whether it's a Coca-Cola, whether it is barbacoa tacos, whether it's a Wendy's, you know, natural fries, you know, whatever they're rolling out right now. I've got food on the brain. It's dinner time. As the price goes down, people want more of it. Now, what you probably missed while you were in your economics course in high school or college or whenever you've come across economics is that you're like, oh, cool, that's demand. All done, right? you know, supply, demand, this goes up, this goes down. I think there's actually a pretty cool little, I call it quibbling here because it feels like I'm just grabbing a tiny little thread here. But I think there's something really, really cool here. When you look at a demand curve and it says, as the price goes down, 5 more people want it. As the price goes down even more, 10 more people want it. What this actually tells us is how responsive people are to price changes. And it's telling me at every point how much the person values a good. So right now, if you're listening to me right now, we can do a little thought experiment. Imagine I'm your economics teacher and I am holding in my hand a ice cold Dr. Pepper. We have Pepsi machines in my building. So it's an unforgivable sin as a Southerner that I'm not talking about Coca-Cola, but whatever. Imagine you have a Dr. Pepper in your hand, or I do, and I'm going to give it to you. And I say, hey, y'all, everybody who's listening, who wants this Dr. Pepper for $5? Very little people will jump in. They're not interested. I say, what about $3? Someone who's thirsty will probably be like, yeah, I'd buy it at that price. And then I drop it to $2. A bunch of people raise their hands and say, oh, yeah, I'll buy a Dr. Pepper at $2. I say, hey, at $1, who would like to buy this Dr. Pepper? Bunch more people are in. And if I say, hey, I'm going to give this Dr. Pepper away for free, most people in here are like, yeah, I'll take a free Dr. Pepper. Well, what this is telling me is I'm dropping that price, and we're actually going back to talking about marginal, right? I'm actually moving this by like cents or 50 cents or 25 cents. You, by jumping in, is it like, so take for instance, Tony was like, he shook his head and said, no, I don't want a Dr. Pepper at $2. But at $1.50, he's like, okay, I'll buy that $1.50 off. I'll buy that Dr. Pepper off of you. What that tells me as an economist, Tony values a Dr. Pepper at $1.50. He couldn't give a rip for that Dr. Pepper at $2. So we know he'd be willing to pay $1.50 for that Dr. Pepper. Now, what happens if the actual price of the Dr. Pepper is free? Well, it's a problem, right? Because Tony values it at $1.50, but the actual market price is zero. And so everybody runs around and says, look, Dr. Pepper's free. Nobody values it. I'll stop being finicky. You can see that I'm talking about fish. I'm talking about natural resources. We all value them at monetary amounts, but because it's free for us to go and access them, we basically don't see a demand curve in real life. There's no way for us to know how much people value each fish. And that's where we're going to tee this up for another episode, is that we in our economic tools will find ways to trace out demand curves so that we know how much people value redfish, how much people value striped bass, how much people value albies when they're fishing for them. Because right now the market says the value is $0, but we know that's incorrect. Okay. So that's a demand curve. I'll breeze through a supply curve really quickly because that's not really going to be our action today.
Ben, can I ask you a question before you get into supply curve?
Yeah.
So one of the things as you're talking, you know, you're talking about, you know, $1.50, $2 for Dr. Pepper. You know, one of the things that, well, I think the biggest thing that drives the fishing economy is abundance. So let me explain kind of what I'm saying is, you know, the price of fuel, I can remember like long time ago, man, it was, I don't know, it was a long time ago, say 10 years ago, maybe a little bit longer. Fuel got up to over $4 a gallon. And, you know, with all the surcharges and everything on marine fuel, it was like over $5 a gallon, and not as many people were fishing. Because it hurt to go fishing. You're like, what? Especially the boats that we use. So that's one thing. And I totally was thinking about when you were talking. But the other thing is, you know, with fishing, I bring up that word effort again. It's almost like with striped bass and a lot of other species that we love them to death. And if the stock's abundant and there's a ton of them out there, you're going to see the demand to go fishing skyrocket because people are successful. You know, they're going out there and they're not like, well, I'm going to bust my hump, I'm going to catch one fish. They're like, man, this is going to be easy, and I'm going to catch 20. Right. And because fishing's good. And that's one of the drivers of the fishing economy. And I know it applies. It's, you know, it's not dollars and cents, but it's basically those new entries that you were talking about that, you know, they'll play golf, they'll play tennis, they'll do something else. If fishing's terrible, there's a certain amount of lunatics that are going to go out there and just do it anyway, because that's what they love and that's all they want to do. But you will lose participants in the sport as the stock declines because they don't experience success. So I know we're talking about a supply curve, but I know your brain is spinning like as I'm talking, because there are applications to your right. specialty, right? And what I just said.
Right. And I really do want to breeze through supply, but let's camp out on demand for a little bit more. And so, like, again, as long as you're not driving, if you point your right index finger to your left eyeball, and have your kind of your wrist blade out so that you're pointing this line, this demand curve in midair. What Tony's talking about is when the stock is good, everybody in that fishery is willing to pay more to access it. Everybody loves it because the fishing is so good. And so move your hand to the right. Boom. The demand curve has shifted outwards, which is this very redemptive cycle for fisheries if they're well managed. This means that you have more loyal advocates now. You have, like Tony said, you have entrants who are interested in helping protect the fishery. And there's now, for an economist, what I love, there's a higher valuation for the stock. Here's the parallel I can think of. When I grew up, and this is in the 90s, redfish stock was recovering from the black and redfish craze, just had gotten pummeled. And I remember I caught an 8-pound redfish. And my grandfather's a Depression era guy. Like, he always wanted to fillet the redfish up, but he was just like, man, that's a good redfish. And I want us to pause for a second. It's an 8-pound red. Nobody's impressed right now that I just said an 8-pound red, but he brought it back to the dock like it was the biggest deal ever. So fast forward now, where folks, especially fly guides, have really nailed down the bull redfish game. And what that tells me is that, especially when now that people are traveling to Louisiana to fish for these, the valuation of that fishery has skyrocketed. Not only because, you know, redfish now are hopefully being regarded as a sport fish rather than just a food fish, but more than that, there's a valuation to a quality, kind of like what you're saying, Tony, not only quantity, but quality of the stock, so that folks are more willing to honestly pay guides, pay to travel, all that to experience that fishery. And again, if you're still holding your hand here because I haven't told you to put it down, we're still talking about the demand curve shifting outwards, so that every person on that line is they're in an economic unison saying, I value this more. I'm willing to pay more because this is awesome. And that's where I think the work y'all are doing, Tony, and I think that's where I see this econ as the most redemptive thing we can have is a bunch of people who love the fish. Now, to your point, we don't want to love it to death. We don't want to do, you know, overutilization and things like that. We got to be smart. But I think the fisheries that suffer the most are the ones that don't have any advocates for them. And that's because, and what's basically happening is you're saying the demand curve is almost non-existent. You know, here in Alabama, this is in the freshwater context, but then we've kind of had a little revival for fly fishing for red-eye bass. And it's the same concept, is that if you love it, you'll protect it. If you love it, you'll fight for it. And there's just folks here who've done the hard work of making that species get that love. Now, again, we've got to worry about access and all these other things that we're not going to get to today. But for me as an economist,
do you have an active chapter in Native Fish Coalition for those red eye bass, I'm guessing?
Yeah. That's primarily what they're after.
I like the boys at Native Fish Coalition, man. They're like, I don't know, man. They're like the, you know, I view them as kind of like the early Scotsmen that, like, you know, why Hadrian built the wall, you know, when he was conquering Britain, he's like marching north and he sees all these painted people and they're they're ferocious and nasty. And he's like, I don't want any part of them. I'm just going to build the wall. Like the native coalition guys, you know, Bob Mallard, the rest of them, man, that is a group that I tip my hat to in freshwater, and they do a lot of Atlantic salmon stuff, sea run brookies and saltwater. But as soon as you said red-eyed bass, I said, I'll bet my hiney that there's a native fish coalition in Ben's area of Alabama.
Right. And that to me, and I think that's another conversation for another day. So let's write that down. But there's this big conversation about gatekeeping versus protecting species. And just to be clear, as a natural resources economist, that's where we go back to trade-offs. If you want people fighting for the fishery, you can't be gatekeeping and telling them that you have no access here. Like there has to be for people to love the species. For people to fight for the species, they have to love the species. If they don't love the species, they have to access the species. If they have to access the species, they've got to fish for the species. And so, I see that as an economist through the lens of supply and demand all day long, because I say, you know, what we're trying to do is to push up people's valuations. You want to see a redfish eat a fly on a popper and be like, oh my gosh, I'm doing this for the rest of my life. You want someone who's walking northeast, landing an albie from the shore and saying, I'm setting my, you know, work calendar to acknowledge the albie run for next year. Because what are they doing? They're saying, look, the value, the true economic value of the species is going outwards the more I experience it. And when you have that, it's kind of, like I said, this virtuous cycle of conservation, protection, definitely catch and release, but also a willingness to fight for the species themselves.
I think you're going to make me cry. I swear to God, somebody gets me in this crazy world, Lord. Somebody finally understands me. I'll cry a little bit, I think. That is it. Yeah, that's it. I mean, that's what we say all the time. Like, what are we leaving our kids? Because guess what? If you don't love it, you're not going to fight for it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Do something to my family and watch what I do to you. they'll write stories about me in psychiatric manuals. Right? Do something to my wife, do something to my kids, and there's a darkness in my soul that will be unleashed, and you will regret it. And so, I mean, like, you know, you love something, you fight for it, and like, you love it by going out there and interacting with it. And it's a part of your life. So thank you, man, for saying that so eloquently. And Ben, let's jump into the supply part, because it's hard for me to judge this right now. I think people are crazy interested, but I think we're putting a gallon of info into a thimble. So let's, at least yeah, for let's me,
wrap it up and let people digest yeah,
at least,
it.
At least I think people may need to listen to this one again to digest it. But we're really, you know, we're doing the Lord's work here, because what we're trying to do is be honest about the science, the condition of the stock, and trying to create better advocates, more knowledgeable people. So let's to finish up this back to school night. Let's talk about that supply part of the demand curve. Right.
And if, like I said, if folks are intellectually worn out, we'll make it easy. So a supply curve just references people's willingness to supply a good and sell it. So just standard business. If the price of a good goes up, people are willing to sell more of it. So if you run a taco shop, tacos are going for $1, you'll sell a couple. If you're like, tacos are selling for $100, oh my gosh, I've been making tacos all night. You know, like that's all a supply curve is saying. And we're going to be really careful here to not mix our metaphors, because I think we have to be very careful in saying who is setting the supply curve when it comes to natural resources. And let's kind of actually push that to another conversation, because that's where we're going to merge economics and ecology all in one, which is kind of what my PhD is in and what I love. But let's just kind of give people a nice ground to land on. That supply curve is, again, just showing people's willingness to supply at every price. You might almost, I mean, if you want a weak proxy here, might be guides, right? Guides are willing to supply people with access to the fishery. As the price goes up, they're willing to put more hours, more days on the water. And so then your quote unquote equilibrium, and everybody who's taking econ is like, oh, this is the X, right? Supply and demand meet. And one point, it's that that is where you have the merger of where people are supplying something and folks want it, and they all agree on that one price. And that's going to give us that nice foundation to talk about going forward. But again, I wanted to race through supply so that I can, in the last couple seconds here, come back and say that when we think about natural resource economics, people are saying the value is zero because there's not a market. And what we just showed, right, by talking about demand is like, no, there is a monetary valuation for these resources. We just have to do the due diligence to find it. And that's what natural resource economics is.
That was pretty awesome. I think, man, I'm all right. I'm going to, no. I'll recover. It's okay. It's just, you know, it's a lot to chew on. And it's all good stuff. I know everyone listening enjoyed it. And I'll set y'all up. You know, we're going to have Ben on here real quick. We're not going to let too much time pass because, you know, we don't want y'all to forget what you just learned right now. So I'll just tease out the topic for the next podcast on, you know, back to school with Ben, I guess we'll call this series, or our resources aren't free. So topic number two, oh my gosh, I'm sorry, guys. My bad. Failures. I can't even read a syllabus. This is why I missed so many assignments. So back to school with Ben. Next chapter is failures, and it's going to focus on market failures and, you know, kind of tease all of that out. And really get into, I guess, what we're experiencing with a lot of our stocks. So, Ben, I hope you had fun, man. I mean, you're kind of a natural at this. You're pretty darn good. It's almost like you stand in front of people and talk about this crap every day.
It's almost like I went to go get a PhD and suffered through it because I loved it so much. Just maybe.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I don't know, dude. It sounds like you've done this before. So
a few times.
We'd love to hear feedback on this, y'all. You know, you can just put it up on put it up on our social media. I know y'all probably follow us on Instagram and Facebook. We get a ton of messages from you. So Ben, here we go, buddy. This is just the start of it, man. Dig in, man. You're awesome podcast guest, and we're going to get you on here as quick as we can for episode 2.
All right.